Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
In his last of four speeches before elections in Iraq, President Bush today acknowledged critics of the war and accepted responsibility for faulty pre-war intelligence.
The United States did not choose war. The choice was Saddam Hussein's. When we made the decision to go into Iraq, many intelligence agencies around the world judged that Saddam possessed weapons of mass destruction. This judgment was shared by the intelligence agencies of governments who did not support my decision to remove Saddam. And it is true that much of the intelligence turned out to be wrong. As president, I'm responsible for the decision to go into Iraq. And I'm also responsible for fixing what went wrong by reforming our intelligence capabilities. And we're doing just that.
The president also said Saddam Hussein was still a threat, and he predicted long-term success in rebuilding Iraq. But his speech comes at a time when much of his agenda is stalled on Capitol Hill, and Democrats want to subpoena White House documents to see if pre-war intelligence was manipulated. Well, joining us on the line from Washington now, Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor. And Linda, first, I just want to get your reaction to that speech and the line that jumped out at us. It is true, much of the pre-war intelligence was wrong.
That's right, and he did take personal responsibility. What struck me, what I was hearing in the speech, was a lot of first person about President Bush. He was almost saying, "Trust me, I believe in this. I believe we must stay the course. I take responsibility for the faulty intelligence, but I think we need to keep going on this." So this is, I guess, if you're George Bush, you hope that the trust me approach that didn't work with Harriet Myers will work this time.
Well, why this time? Why now? The stakes in the upcoming Iraqi election are high for the Iraqis. They're also high for President Bush. Mm-hmm. What is your sense? That did this come out of nowhere?
No, I think this is him, just by dint of the fact that he's given four straight speeches in a couple of weeks on Iraq, really pounding home to his audience, which is foremost the American people, but also the rest of the world, that this is a fight worth fighting, that progress has been made. He, in the previous speeches, provided a lot of specifics about ways in which progress has been made politically, militarily, and economically. So you really have to take the four as a package.
Well, the Boston Globe is reporting today that Democrats in Congress want to subpoena the president's daily briefings from before the war. And just to remind people, the president's been saying that Democrats and others saw the same intelligence he did. They claim they didn't. They didn't get to see these daily briefings. And they wanted to determine if pre-war intelligence was not just wrong, but manipulated. Your thoughts?
Well, this question of whether everybody had access to the same intelligence is an argument that's been going on for weeks and weeks. In the president's defense, most members of Congress did not read all the intelligence information that they had at their disposal. The Congress is crying foul that they didn't have the information they needed, but the White House can respond. You didn't read what you had available to you. But this is definitely a sore point in the debate, and we'll have to see what happens.
Well, Linda, in a pre-buttal, beforehand rebuttal to the president's speech this morning, Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid said the president has been 0-for-3 in these speeches, and he struck out, each time. Do you agree? Because we're also seeing his ratings, his poll ratings, rise.
Mm-hmm. I don't agree with Harry Reid. This is him giving a political reaction. The speeches have been interesting. They've had details that we've never heard before. They've had a pitch toward victory and not a plan for victory, not just stay the course, which I think Americans were hearing as stay in Iraq forever. So I think they have given people a sense, and the president's polls have bumped up a little bit. I'm not sure that he can maintain that. He can't just keep giving two speeches a week for the rest of his presidency.
Linda Feldman of the Christian Science Monitor. After President Bush's speech today, in which he accepted responsibility for faulty pre-war intelligence, seeming to acknowledge critics of the war. Linda, thanks so much.
Great, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, as part of our ongoing look at Medicaid and Medicare, we want to take a few minutes today to talk about government-subsidized home health care, something also being talked about in Congress and in homes across America. In a moment, a national health care expert on the state-to-state disparity in Medicaid-covered live-in home health care. But first, meet Richard Gulati of Waltham, Massachusetts.
For 25 years, I was a practicing lawyer. For the last 21 years, I have been a home health care giver. First for my parents, in the last 9 years for my wife. Just a little closer here. Okay, take a few steps, Sandy.
After Richard Gulati's wife, Sandy, suffered a series of debilitating strokes, he began, for the second time, to take care of a loved one at home.
Straight back now, love. Straight back. And I'll see if we can get you to give you a little hip action here, Sandy. Good girl. Good girl.
Some of you may recall, I have a personal interest in this topic. About a year ago, my mom began to spiral into dementia. She was too healthy for a nursing home, but not independent enough for independent living. Her insurance company had folded, and at 80, she wasn't likely to get new coverage. But luckily, after spending down her meager assets on a home health aide, she qualified for a full-time home aide under New York State's Medicaid program. And she's been living with a young woman in the house her children bought and owned years ago. A home health aide from Medicaid, something astonishing to Richard Gulati because his state, Massachusetts, covers nursing home care, but not a home aide, except for several hours a week. Well, to understand why people like Richard think this should change, we asked him to tell his story.
I made a promise to my father. He said, Richard, I've been told by two doctors that I have 6 months to live. I don't want to go to a nursing home. Will you take care of me? And I said, Dad, as long as I have breath in my body and you don't lose your mind, I'll take care of you. Well, I kept that promise, but he lived 11 and a half years. He held on for 11 and a half years, but the last year or two was very miserable. He was struggling for every breath. He was on oxygen every day, 24 hours a day for over 12 years. But the last year of his life was terrible. I didn't sleep with my wife. I slept on that sofa over there behind his hospital bed. He was on morphine for 8.5 months.
And meanwhile, we should say his wife, your mother, also became ill.
My mother, while I was taking care of my father, first there was some kind of dementia. We didn't know what it was, and she became incontinent. I started to change her 3 or 4 times a day. Eventually, she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and she became a threat to herself and to my father. So the last 11 months of her life, I did have to put her in a nursing home.
So you've got, at that point in your story, you have two parents who are in desperate need. Yeah. And you ended up having to put one in the nursing home. But some would say, why not both? I mean, after 11 years, why not take advantage of that help?
Well, first of all, I kept a promise. And a couple of doctors said he was actually kept alive by love. Not only of my own, but of my wife, his daughter-in-law, and my son. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I love you so much. He said, you've let me live in dignity and die in dignity. And he said, you're a pretty good guy, Richard, but I don't know what you did to deserve Sandy. She's an angel.
Now, this is your wife.
This is my wife. And my wife is an angel. For that whole 11 and a half years, that's you.
She's pointing at herself.
For the first year or so, I was trying to practice law. I had a lot of money in SEPs and IRAs. And little by little, I started to withdraw from them. After 11 and a half years, I decided I didn't want to go back to law because I was afraid I'd hurt somebody because I was I was uninvolved with the law. I was just more of a nurse than anything else. She never complained once in that 11 and a half years. I used every single bit of the funds. So I had a son going to Northeastern at the time, and we wanted to put him through school. And little by little by little, I became broke. She saw what was happening. She never complained once. And I didn't want to put him in a nursing home because he would have felt abandoned. He became very frail and frightened, and I wanted to comfort him, and I'm glad I did.
Shortly after this, you have a brief respite.
After he died, I had a respite of approximately 2 years before my wife had a stroke and got ill. And I had... In the interim, decided not to go back to law. I sold real estate for Century 21 in Waltham for a while. But then after about a year of trying to do both, I realized I had to stay home full time. She has become increasingly disabled, and she is incontinent, so I'll be changing her about 4, 5, 6 times a day. She has a little bell, and I come down when she needs me, and I want to keep her dry. Mm-hmm. No bed sores.
You have to lift her?
I have to lift her, put her on the potty, put her back in bed, put her in the wheelchair. And she's pointing to her stomach. She doesn't miss any meals. She is an absolute delight. She is teaching my son and I how to be sick with dignity. She doesn't complain.
So essentially you're saying that in much the same way you made a promise to your father.
I wasn't going to do less with my wife. It's been a very difficult job. I thought being a lawyer was rough. But it's not anywhere near. This is 10 times rougher. It's a job that requires constant attention around the clock. Quite frankly, you get tired, you lack sleep, but it's something that I'm committed to. I have a home health aide that comes for 2 hours every day, Monday through Friday, and she bathes my wife.
So that's Medicaid?
Yes.
Let me ask you this, though. Would long-term care insurance pay for a full-time home health aide, private pay?
When I was going broke, obviously the insurance was one of the first things to go. We find that, quite honestly, that she and I together, I can do most of it, but I need a break. We need more help from the state. And quite frankly, it would be great if I could get some kind of financial help from the state. Quite the reverse was true when I cashed in all my IRAs and SEPs, because not only did I pay the tax on it, but because I was 59 and a half years of age, under 59 and a half years of age, I had to pay the 10% penalty that the federal government invokes when you take money out of an SEP or an IRA. So the government's got to wake up a little bit there.
And because you're feeling, in effect, they made out on you.
Well, yes, I saved the government probably $1 million or more by not putting them in a nursing home and taking care of them myself. And my reward for that was that 10% penalty in addition to the tax. Nursing homes are necessary, I'm sure, in many instances, as it was for my mother. But quite frankly, it saves the Commonwealth and every state, I imagine, and the federal government a lot of money if you take care of a person at home.
What do you say to people who say, but Medicaid was mainly started for absolutely indigent women in particular, and children? It's not for you.
Well, quite frankly, I'm as close to being indigent now as you could imagine. Had I known I was going to take care of my mom and dad that long, and then my wife, I might have handled my money a little better. Mm. When you're so consumed taking care of individuals that need full-time care, it's next to impossible. Did you enjoy this? I know you didn't have much to say. I wish you would say more. I don't know how much time either one of us has left, but it's going to be spent watching the Red Sox and the Patriots and the old classic movies and silly holding hands once in a while and sharing a moment or two. Sometimes we pass the whole evening and we say about 3 words, but it's still, she's there.
Richard Gulati of Massachusetts, where Medicaid does not cover a live-in aid. Well, would it save the state money if it did? We'll talk to a health expert after the break. More coming up here and now. Continuing our look today at home health care and Medicaid and how the Medicaid program varies drastically from state to state. We just spoke with Richard Gulati, who, with his adult son Greg, is caring for his wife at home in Massachusetts. Massachusetts Medicaid coverage does not offer live-in health aids. Its federal Medicaid funds are largely funneled into the state's nursing homes. New York, as we mentioned, offers full-time live-in home health care aides under its Medicaid program if patients meet certain prerequisites, including liquidating their assets and relinquishing their Social Security to Medicaid. Stuart Altman is an economist and a professor of health policy at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. He has also served in Republican and Democratic administrations in Washington, and he joins us now on a crackly cell phone from New York. Professor Altman, welcome.
Well, thank you, Robin. It's a pleasure to be back.
And first of all, some of the things that Richard Gulati just raised, let's get to those first. He says that taking care for his wife and his parents before her at home actually saves the state money, that it's actually less expensive for the state to have these catastrophically ill and usually dying people at home as opposed to nursing homes.
In general, he's right, and it sounds to me like from what he's done, he really has saved the state a lot of money. There's no question that, in general, if you can care for people at home, it is better for them, and it is far less expensive.
Well, we should point out that there is a sweeping health care bill that's been passed by the Senate here in Massachusetts that includes an amendment that might enable more people to stay at home and receive state-paid-for care. But that's still under consideration. Branch us out. How much does it vary from state to state?
Oh, it varies tremendously. Now, New York happens to be one of the more progressive, if not the most progressive. Well, that and Wisconsin and one or two others in terms of the use of home health care as a real serious alternative to institutional care. Unfortunately, Massachusetts just isn't there.
What are the pressures? If, in fact, it saves a state money to put people in their own home, what are the pressures that are stopping that?
Well, I think there are two things. First of all, there are cases where it doesn't save the state money. There are people, like any other program, that would begin taking advantage of it isn't the right word, where there is question of whether they really would wind up in the institution. And after all, 24-hour home care is not inexpensive. So you're not dealing with something that is a trivial expense.
Right. So, and there is a fear, we should say, that members of the nursing home industry have spoken out with that concern that if this is offered by the state of Massachusetts, at least, people will take advantage of it. Now, when you hear someone like Richard Gulati, that's not a pejorative. He needs that help. But are you saying that people would take unfair advantage of it?
Well, unfair is there's no question they will use it. And then where do you draw the line? And what I think the nursing home people are saying is that there are people who would begin to use it inappropriately. I don't think there's much justification for not putting together a decent home care benefit. I think it actually helps the nursing home industry by reducing the pressure on them to provide care for the number of people that they're getting hit with.
Because of these disparities, in addition to people who are, you know, severely ill and need help at home, not getting full-time aid in states like Massachusetts, we understand there are people who are in nursing homes who really don't belong there because they need just a little extra help and they can't get that at home.
Well, that's no question about that. I mean, you get into situations where, you know, a little extra help here and there could really keep people out. Over the years, the program has tried to improve home care around the country. And I think we do a better job than we did 10 years ago. But, you know, it's far from perfect from what I can see.
Well, what are some of the numbers here? We understand a year in a nursing home can cost more than $50,000, while home or even community care can run between $12,000 and $30,000 a year. So as we said, it seems to make financial sense. Can the Medicaid program, you know, afford? What are the other pressures on the Medicaid program that make this not an appealing alternative?
Medicaid is a very expensive program and growing more expensive. You know, you're competing between home care and hospital care and renal dialysis and all the other complicated but expensive and important services. So costs are a factor. But in the case of home care, every study that I've seen, for the most part, supports its use, provided you can keep people from using it inappropriately. That's where the cost could really skyrocket.
Well, Professor Albin, give us some historical context here for Medicaid. Was it just developed for women and children, indigent women and children?
No. No, from the very beginning, Medicaid has been covering long-term care services for the elderly from the very beginning. It's changed. The home care part of it has grown substantially over the years. But there was always since 1966, a nursing home component. But it too has changed in terms of the amount that Medicaid pays for the benefits.
What are some of the factors that have changed? I'm thinking, you know, people are living longer. And also, it used to be, I mean, my grandparents were at home with my mother who wasn't working.
Well, I think you hit two of them right on the head. First of all, we are unfortunately living longer, and as a result, more and more of us unfortunately reach the same situation that your mother's in. The good news is that she was old enough, you know, and the bad news is that we get these debilitating conditions at the end of life. And second, it is true that people, often children are in other states, like you're in one and your mother is in another, and the children themselves are older. So the ability for families to take care of their own is substantially less than it was 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Do you see Medicaid ultimately state by state changing to respond to this need?
Well, if anything, I think we're going in the other direction. The pressure, unfortunately, to cut $50 billion out of the Medicaid program over 10 years is putting states into pressure to ask people to pay more and more of the bill. And I don't see us getting more liberal in terms of this benefit. I wish we would, but I don't see that happening.
Stuart Altman, a professor at Brandeis University here in Massachusetts. Stuart, thanks for speaking with us.
Take care, Robin. Thank you very much.
And this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, the election in Iraq. What's the view from Baghdad, and how are Iraqis in the U.S. feeling? Also, the First Lady of Crime Writing, Baroness P.D. James. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Dow.
Facing increasingly violent protests, the Chinese government has turned to a time-honored strategy for dealing with civil unrest. Don't let the story get out. Last week, after police killed several people while suppressing a demonstration against a power plant, Chinese officials did everything to keep the incident out of the press. Reporters were banned from the region, and key words associated with the event were banned from major search engines such as Google. The Chinese adopted the same kind of blackout strategy in the wake of a toxic chemical spill that occurred last month, refusing to warn people living downstream from the spill about the danger to their drinking supply. The slick of cancer-causing benzene was triggered by an explosion in a chemical plant in northeast China. It's now traveling along China's Songhua River toward Russia. Matt Forney of Time Magazine has been covering the story and the cover-up, and he joins us from Beijing. And Matt, first a geography lesson. Tell us more about the Songhua River.
It flows first west across northeast China, and then it turns around and flows east along the border with Russia, where it combines with the Russian River, and together they become the Amur, and then they flow out into the sea north of Japan.
Well, now this slick moving its way down the river is expected to reach Russian territory this week. China did initially delay telling Russia about the serious problem, but now apparently the two countries are working together. What's the latest on how they are working together?
They say they've got a joint team taking measurements, monitoring the slick. There's a Russian crew which is building a diversionary dam to keep the slick away from major Russian cities.
In Time magazine, you followed the timeline of the initial cover-up of this pollution of the water. Tell us a little bit about that.
The explosion took place on November 13th, and everybody knew that. The Chinese media covered it. But Chinese officials were very specific. They said there was no air pollution. They didn't mention water. And that went on for about 10 days. Nobody knew that this slick was heading down toward the city of Harbin, which has a downtown population of about 3.5 million people. And that was a conscious decision. It wasn't bad planning. Chinese officials later acknowledged that they were communicating reasonably well within the Chinese system. They just made the decision not to notify people who might be drinking or using this water. And when that became clear and the Chinese media jumped on it, and some of China's more progressive publications wrote about this before they were told not to, and then much reporting ended, the Chinese government actually came back and apologized. But it was pretty clear that nobody had really done anything that was unexpected from the government's perspective, because everybody was aware that people weren't being told about this poisonous slick bearing down upon their city.
What's expected to happen now? Because we remember, the way China handled SARS and avian flu, SARS in particular, there was a lot of criticism. In fact, the Beijing mayor and the health minister were fired for mishandling the release of information about acute respiratory syndrome in early 2003 in China. But also, newspaper editors were fired if they wrote about it. So what's expected to happen now after this spill?
Well, China's already removed the head of its State Environmental Protection Administration because he hadn't properly planned for contingencies involving, you know, river pollution like this. And the chatter that I'm hearing from Chinese who profess to know this sort of thing is that he's being made a fall guy because we know from information we've gathered about meetings that took place in Heilongjiang province, which is where the river flows through, at meetings that were held by the governor of the province, that they consciously decided not to tell the population, and that they had also notified their bosses in Beijing very quickly and hadn't heard back very quickly from them up in Beijing. Chinese have a phrase for this, which is Neijian Wai Song, which means that we'll present the impression that we're being very open, but in fact we're controlling everything very closely. We're controlling information very closely. That was their policy.
So an official has been sacked, but do you think that these newspaper editors who've been so critical of the cover-up of the spill will now also be fired? I mean, what direction is China going in as far as transparency?
It was interesting to see how Chinese newspapers covered this story. Some of China's best newspapers barely covered it at all because they were instructed not to. There was a magazine that came out with a very detailed story, shockingly detailed. And the reason was that they got up there to the northeast part of the country, reported the story, and published it before the propaganda organs could get their act together and issue a proclamation barring coverage. And once that happened, then a lot of other newspapers jumped in also and covered this story in a very critical way. I've heard Chinese reporters excitedly calling this kind of a seminal moment in Chinese journalism. Now, if the government comes back and cracks down on them and starts removing editors, then that would be quite a blow to Chinese journalists who almost for the first time were covering a story for what they considered the public good.
Matt Forney, this also comes as two things are happening in China. First of all, the economy is exploding. And secondly, the spotlight is on China as the 2008 Olympics in Beijing approach. So to the first question, this exploding economy, do you see other evidence that there might be other environmental problems that you know, are being covered up by China? And how is all of this going to affect how the world views China as the Olympics approach?
China does not face a looming environmental crisis. China already faces an environmental crisis, which could become a social crisis as well. Some of the worst cases of riots and conflict between Chinese peasants and authorities have come because of factories that have polluted groundwater and led to birth defects, and people have felt that the government hasn't taken responsibility for this. As for the Olympics, Beijing, if I'm not mistaken, is the most polluted capital city in the world. The government has promised that it will in some way clean up the air, mostly by closing factories. Before the Beijing Games in 2008, those games are bearing down on us, and the air quality is still pretty bad.
Matt Forney, reporting from China for Time magazine. He's been speaking to us from Beijing. And Matt, we really appreciate it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
We're just going to take a second now to remind you that, as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. You can send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line, leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Still to come, the view of the world from Paul Winter, who's sitting on top of the world this time of year. You're listening to Here and Now. research team led by the Harvard School of Public Health has found that eating a lot of fiber-rich grains, fruits, and vegetables does not appear to reduce the chances of getting colorectal cancer. Say what? The study tests what's been the popular belief that eating a high-fiber diet is a good way to prevent most common forms of cancer. The study appears in today's Journal of the American Medical Association, along with an editorial written by Dr. John Barron, internist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire. And Dr. Barron spoke with Here and Now producer Alex Ashlock.
Well, Dr. Barron, beyond the headline we see in the Boston Globe today, which says doubts cast on fiber's effect on cancer, what does this study say?
Well, the headline basically has it right, that for the majority of people in Western societies, the amount of dietary fiber taken in doesn't seem to correlate with the risk of colon cancer.
Tell us about the methodology. How was the study done? It's said to be the largest ever on this particular issue.
This study was very, very nice. It gathered data from other studies and put them all together in one sort of statistical pot. And with the increased numbers of subjects, the additional statistical firepower provided enabled the investigators to see things more clearly than previous investigations could do.
And those previous investigations, I think, have led most people to believe that eating a high-fiber diet is a good way to prevent colorectal cancer. But this study seems to say the opposite.
Well, actually, the fiber idea began in the 1970s. But as we've learned more about how to measure diet and how to study its associations with the diseases like cancer, the majority of studies actually haven't shown much of an association with cancer. Some do, but over the past 10, 15 years or so, most well-done follow-up studies haven't seen much. And this combined analysis confirmed that.
That, I guess, goes to what one of the doctors in the newspaper today said, that it's sort of an urban myth that a high-fiber diet is really a good way to prevent colon cancer.
That's a nice way of putting it. Arguably, it's an African myth, because the original hypothesis, the idea that fiber would be protective, came out of some observations that Dennis Burkett made in Africa.
You write in the editorial that accompanies the study today that more research is needed about fiber's long-term effect on colorectal cancer. What other things do you want to know about that?
Well, there was one intriguing idea in the meta-analysis that was published today that caught my eye, and that is that individuals with very low intakes of fiber had an increased risk, the bottom 10% roughly. Obviously, this doesn't apply to most of us, but it'd be fascinating to understand what the lack of fiber in this case is doing there. This study really doesn't suggest that fiber is protective for people with a balanced, healthy diet. It suggests that if you are extreme at the low end, then there may be a problem.
So finally, Doctor, what is the take-home message here? Colorectal cancer is the third most common form of cancer. What should people do, especially those who have this type of cancer running in their family? It runs in my family. What should I be doing?
We've learned a lot in the past 10 or 15 years about the prevention of colorectal cancer. Aspirin and calcium supplements appear to help. But those are not magic bullets, and they never will be. So at the end of the day, screening, talking to your doctor, those are going to be important steps.
Dr. John Barron, an internist at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire, he spoke with Here Now's Alex Ashlock. Dr. Barron's editorial on the study on colorectal cancer appears in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. A few years ago, well, decades now, I hosted my first radio program, and people still ask me, what was that theme song? It was Paul Winter's Icarus. Later, I was privileged to cover Paul Winter for a story at the Grand Canyon where he played his haunting song Wolf Eyes and the wolves cried back at him. Today, we get to talk to Paul Winter about another project, his celebration of the winter solstice, broadcast on National Public Radio stations around the country, and quite a tradition. Last year's celebration has just been released on a 2-CD set along with a bonus DVD of the performance. It's called Silver Solstice, Paul Winter Consort and Friends. This year's celebration is scheduled for this weekend at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City. And Paul Winter joins us on the line to tell us more. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
What a delight to talk to you. You know, thousands listen to the solstice celebration every year. And what is with you and the winter solstice?
It kind of was a cosmic milestone that came into my life when we were invited to be artists in residence at this amazing cathedral in New York called St. John the Divine. When we first came there, I had the idea to find the most universal milestone in the year which we could celebrate and which could feel kindred or inclusivist to peoples of all kinds of backgrounds. And it struck me that the winter solstice, which is the end of one year and the beginning of the next as the sun turns back in its course, I thought that this should be an appropriate event to celebrate there, because we were invited to do whatever we wanted in a totally secular way. Even though it's a cathedral, it's Episcopal, it's very open, very welcoming, and very eclectic in its heritage.
Well, let's listen to some of the music that it was a result of last year's celebration. This is Harvest Fair. Paul Winter, who do you have this year?
Renato Braz is a wonderful singer from Brazil who's of Guarani Indian heritage but grew up in the northeast of Brazil with that African heritage, and also he's the most remarkable young singer that I've met from Brazil in a long time. Also Paul McCandless, the great oboe player who was the original oboist in the consort in the late 60s and early 70s, will be playing with us for the first time at the cathedral in 20 years.
And he is also a member of another of my favorite groups, Oregon, for those who
absolutely
are recognizing the name, so he'll be there.
And dancing and drumming of the Forces of Nature Dance Theater Ensemble, who perform mostly in West African traditions.
And is the Dmitry Pokrovsky Ensemble returning?
I was just going to mention them. Absolutely.
Paul Winter, is it true that their voices appear on the Survivor theme?
Yes. We don't talk about it a lot, but it's true. That's the first track of our album, Earthbeat, our joint album with the Pokrovsky Ensemble from late 80s. It's called Kursky Funk.
So it's a huge show. There's a huge sphere of the earth that travels around the cathedral. There's a huge, I want to call it a bong. What is it,
A gong. Bong is that's a good coinage, Robin. That's fine. It's a gong that's bonged. It's the largest gong in the world. It's 7 feet across, and it's rigged to the ceiling, to the vault, and it is played by a player in a bosun's chair next to it, who's also suspended, and they rise 100 feet into the air at the symbolic moment of solstice when the sun is returning.
Well, Paul Winter, you've been in the middle of these kinds of huge celebrations, the winter solstice. On the other hand, as I mentioned in the introduction, you've also had these solitary music moments. I was privileged to be part of one at the Grand Canyon. You're out there on the lip of the canyon, playing the Wolf Eyes song, and they did call back from the canyon. I mean, it was just spectacular. What's that like to have a wolf sing along?
Well, in the rare times that that's happened, it's been very gratifying. I mean, it's very, you're communing through sound, and it's as if they're kind of saying, well, it's okay for you to be there. It's very rare that you can get close enough to them that to even have them hear you, and those have been great epiphanic moments.
Winter, obviously I'm a fan of the music, but I wonder, you know, it's such a, what's the word, it's such a...
Eclectic,
but also positive sound. Do you ever, I mean, does anyone ever say to you, come on, Paul Winter, come on over to the dark side, let's hear some brooding music, let's hear something about the despair of life, and you ever thought of crossing over to the dark side?
There's a term in Brazil, in Portuguese, called saudade, which means kind of a bittersweet, yearning feeling. We don't have really the equivalent word in English. And you hear in the voice of a whale, or you hear it in the Illan pipes from Ireland, or in Arto Tunchboyasian singing, it's just about the soul of life in its whole spectrum. And you can't define it as happy and sad, really, although it's anybody's call as to how it affects them. Arto Tunçboyasyan, who sings on the album, is originally from Armenia. 28 members of his family were killed by the Turks in the genocide, and he lives with a depth of sorrow that we can't even imagine. I appreciate that you say that our music has a positive sound. Certainly, at the time of renewal in the winter solstice, that's pretty much what we're celebrating, although we wanted to embrace the whole gamut of the human experience.
Paul Winter. For more on this weekend's winter solstice celebration, go to our website, here-now.org. Paul, thanks so much.
You're very welcome, Robin. Thank you, and what a great pleasure to reconnect.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now. Sari na je hei du na jamai irka tere mi merturata.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.